and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today on our 52nd podcast. We are 1 year old today, so happy birthday to us. We're joined by Stephen Wilmot, Companies Editor.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Good. And over in the control room, Graham Davis. How are you, Graham?
Hello, John. Very well.
Good. And you've been looking after the news again this week?
Back in the news saddle once more.
Yeah, it's not going to last for long, though.
No. Bradley's make back
the,
tomorrow.
Make the most of it. Yep. When he deigns to join us, we will have James Norrington here with us too, because James has written a couple of features in the magazine this week, which it will be good to discuss. Okay, so lots going on this week. Let's start with the news in the world at large. 7 days. Graham, you had the joy of putting this together this week, and some interesting little snippets there.
Yeah, it's been a busy week. The usual sort of economic macro stuff floating around. Markets fell a bit on China concerns, and then today they've bounced back because US economic data looks a bit iffy, and rate rises are disappearing over the horizon again. So is that good news? I'm not sure, but equity markets like it.
Yeah, it's a recurring story
now, absolutely.
It seems. And I mean, to my mind, the link between what the US rates are going to do and what markets are doing is becoming increasingly tenuous, because I think the last time that we knew they postponed the rise, the markets actually fell in response.
So yes. Yeah, it's
becoming very hard to second guess
what's going to happen. To read that one, yeah. But thankfully, we have plenty of sort of corporate stuff going on, which is of interest. We had a couple of big M&A deals announced and some very interesting IPOs as well. I mean, the main M&A, the week started with the final terms of the SAB Miller and AB InBev deal, which looks like it might be the third biggest takeover in history.
Wow. Well, it's big business, beer.
Yeah.
Big business. I mean, you've been looking at this, Stephen, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very interesting deal. I mean, it is on the face of it very complex, but actually for retail shareholders, they don't really need to worry about the main complexity, which is the fact that there's this partial share offer as well, because that's basically been designed for the two largest SAB shareholders, who are Altria, the US tobacco group, and a company called Bevco, which is actually just the family investment vehicle of the Santo Domingo family, which sold its Bavaria brand, which is the leading brand in Colombia, which apparently, I find this statistic extraordinary, amounted to 4% of Colombian GDP at its peak.
What was the rest of Colombian GDP? Cocaine?
let's assume that GDP was a non-black market, a white market figure.
Yes. I've been watching Narcos on Netflix. If anyone has Netflix, I'd strongly recommend watching that. It's absolutely brilliant. But we've talked about Netflix a lot in the past. Let's talk about SAB right now.
Yeah, anyway, so there's this partial share deal thing, which makes all the statements. If any readers of SAB shareholders have been trying to follow the statements, have been very complicated because of this partial share sale thing. But anyway, you don't really need to worry about that, because getting the cash offer is a no-brainer. It's higher, £44 per share, which is a good sort of 50% above where they were a month ago before this latest approach. Even though, you know, you could argue that there's quite a takeover premium baked into the price even then. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's a really good price.
Well, SAB, even when I was covering the beverage sector, I found it a very challenging company to call.
It always seems to defy expectations. Always looked expensive.
Yeah.
And that was partly because there was this takeover premium. It's interesting. Salutary in a way, because it was worth it in the end, because people did get 50% more than even that. So who did believe in the story? The reality was it was the second largest brewer. ABI is a famously acquisitive company, which was the largest brewer. I mean, it's easy to say in retrospect, but it did always look like they were going to make an approach.
Well, the whole industry has been characterized by M&A over the years.
Exactly, and because of the falling volumes in the West, and it's a very economies of scale driven business, there's been a sort of cast iron case for consolidation.
It kind of could be the end. I mean, this looks like the last big deal in the
sector. Endgame. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, people have pointed out that other large brewers are private. Heineken is, it's not private, but it's
family controlled,
yeah. and they're not selling out. Yeah, I mean, ABI has obviously bought Budweiser in the US, and SAB bought Miller. These two companies, in fact, have consolidated the sector, and now they've merged. So, well, they will. Actually, it'll take probably, people expect, a year or so to work through all the the competition concerns.
Yeah, because there'll be a few bits to sell off, presumably, from
both
businesses.
The Miller Coors JV in the US, which is SAB's exposure to the US market, one assumes it will be sold to the Molson Coors company, mm-hmm. which is the Canadian leading brewing company. So they've got an obvious buyer there for the JV, and there's also problems in China. Problems meaning both ABI and SAB have big market shares, and so that's an issue.
Yeah, so there'll be a few smaller deals yet to come in the sector.
Yeah.
And obviously, as we know from the recent purchase of Meantime, they're on the lookout for small, high growth assets.
Well, I think the UK is an interesting one because, it's not SAB's core market in a way, but basically the rise of craft brewing in the US and the fact that the UK has always been very dominated by ales and these small local brewing companies has always been a challenge for these big global brewers. So it really, I think one of the interesting things about this story is how little political attention it's got after the fuss that was made over to AstraZeneca earlier in the year. It's interesting that this deal, which is about as big, has received almost no interest. And I guess it comes down to the fact that, South African Brewers, which merged with Miller, which is a US brand. So it kind of feels like a foreign deal in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay, interesting. I noticed Diageo had flogged its wine business this week as well.
Yeah, to an Australian company. Diageo's got these problems in China because of the clampdown on gift-giving. And it seems like, in China, as in the West, giving a bottle of spirits is a classic gift. So
yeah.
It's had its problems, and so it's trying to focus on its core business, the classic.
The usual. I'm talking to China. I noticed there was some pretty iffy data out from China, Graham.
Yeah, the balance of trade has ballooned out to $60 billion. Imports in September fell by 17.7%. So it signs further signs of real domestic problems, potential domestic weakness in China there. So exports dropped a tiny bit, but it was the imports that was the big headline figure this week. And notably, Chinese GDP figure is expected on Monday.
7%?
7% is what they're targeting, but across the board, pretty much across the board, analysts are coming in at 6.7, 6.6, so it looks like they might undershoot a little bit. What that will do to the equity markets, who knows? What happens then normally, what has happened in previous quarters, is that the figures look a little bit weak and everybody says, oh well, the Chinese all launch more stimulus and markets go up, so we'll see what happens next week.
Stimulus indeed. Always there when you need it.
Yeah,
I was gonna say another good anecdotal example of weak Chinese imports might be Burberry's profit warning this morning.
Yes absolutely.
not in this magazine, but like Diageo, Burberry is struggling to sell its luxury goods to China.
Yeah, well, it was always a big part of the story there, China. And
But it was always a big part of the story, but somehow, the shares are off 12% or were when I looked this morning.
Yep.
And that's because they said that in the second quarter, things slowed. The second quarter meaning July to September, business slowed, and they mentioned China in particular. So, it seems to have been a significant effect there.
Worries indeed. Let's turn back to M&A because we had some other little deals back here.
Yeah, two deals here, which are sort of two love triangles, shall we say?
Ooh,
because both exchanging and a United Arab Emirates hospital operator, Al Noor, and both these companies are quoted here, and both look like they've got competing bids on the table for them. Exchanging has accepted an offer from Capita, but whilst accepting the offer from Capita, has said that it is still in talks with Apollo, a private equity group, on a potential bid of 170p, which would trump Capita's 160p a share bid. The Al Noor one's a little bit more complicated. The South African business has agreed a combination of sorts with Al Noor, but a rival NMC Health has also said that it would like to do a deal with Al Noor.
So, well, NMC is listed here, isn't it?
Al Noor's shares went up 20%. On the announcement of the deal with Mediclinic, which is the South African suitor, but NMC is waiting in the wings there, so there could be more action there. Just two interesting little trysts there.
Yeah, it's an interesting company. I know it runs essentially hospitals in the United Arab Emirates.
Mm.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
which but is it's good
which,
business.
Which is what NMC does.
Yeah,
Mediclinic is slightly different in that it has South African interests.
So, Mediclinic's really quite large. I mean, it's a five billion pound company. Oh, I mean, you know, quoting Rand in Johannesburg, but it's a really very substantial company. And if Mediclinic does succeed in doing this reverse takeover of Al-Noor, which will involve it taking its London listing, it will shoot into the FTSE 100.
Okay. Well, healthcare is big business and only set to go one way, really. Okay. Right. And, oh, James, nice of you to join us. How are you doing, James?
I'm all right, John, actually. Good. I've had to warm up properly.
Good. Okay. Well, I hope you're warmed up because I'll be quizzing you strongly in a minute. Okay. So that's this week's M&A. Let's talk about IPOs because an exciting front there as well.
Yeah. Well, tomorrow, Friday of this week, should see the we'll see the London debut of Worldpay. It started conditional trading on Tuesday and the shares have been popular. This is an electronic payments company. And actually, it's going to be valued at north of £6 billion. It's a candidate to go straight into the FTSE 100 at the next review and the biggest IPO in London since the Royal Mail.
Well, this is a hot sector. Mm. I mean, payments is one part of what a bigger term would perhaps be fintech that people are banding around at the moment. Yeah. That was a big sigh there, Stephen. You still, there's entirely convinced by the whole concept?
No. It appeals to all sides of London, doesn't it? You know.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Silicon Roundabout meets.
Indeed, fintech is big in the UK. It's one of the biggest areas, unsurprisingly, given the predominance of the city. But yeah, so Worldpay. Kind of, it's like a PayPal thing, I guess.
Yeah, it's payment processing. But I mean, it's a huge operation. I mean, not many people may have heard of it, but it's a huge operation. It's
spun out of RBS, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. But a couple of private equity groups took it on and have invested quite heavily in it, rather than taking costs out, which is what private equity often does. But it processed £370 billion worth of transactions last year, and the first half of this year, transactions of £195 billion. So this is, you know, there's a lot of money passing through its systems. I think Theron here quoted first half revenues of £1.94 billion and profits of £183 million.
Yeah, big.
Up 13%. So growth, you know, it's a growing company.
So, I mean, I presume we haven't looked at this in much detail yet, so I doubt we have a strong view.
Theron sort of gave an overview of it this week in the news section, but I mean, it also said that at the moment it looks like at the listing price it's valued at around 16 times underlying cash profits, but we need to have a closer look at the financials before we come to a firm recommendation on this. But it's not, you know, this is a very competitive field. It's up against people like PayPal.
Optimal Payments. That's another UK listed company.
Which is also a tip of ours, I think.
Oh, is it really?
I know Theron's been very keen on that sector, the mobile payments. I mean, everyone, you know, and Ian Smith, our banking guy, he wrote that End of Cash feature, which talks about this sort of step change that we've seen with people in London, you know, using contactless cards for the tube. And
it seems to be enabled by mobile proliferation as well, smartphone proliferation.
Yes.
So, yeah, interesting stuff. And I noticed Apple Pay, of course, you've got as well lurking there in the background, which I notice is being accepted in more and more places.
It's a growing field.
It is a growing field, but then there's a lot of room to grow into. You know, the suggestion that we heard the other day at our growth seminar from Scottish Mortgage Trust was that, you know, payments is a big business and they're stepping in to avoid that, you know, bigger banks, the bigger processors haven't perhaps innovated as quickly as they should. So there's definitely room for someone like Worldpay to take a bit of market there. Yeah.
Not good news for check printers at the likes of Deliveroo and so forth, but that's another story.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, I notice we have another IPO potentially coming up soon.
There's two more. I mean, briefly, not probably one. Some of our readers might be interested in this, but they're not going to be able to get hold of the shares very easily. Is Ferrari is floating, or Fiat is floating 10% of the Ferrari business in New York, which will give it a valuation of around $10 billion.
I think I'll give that one a miss. Actually,
yeah. Exactly.
McCarthy and Stone looks a lot more interesting.
Yes, formerly a quoted company in the UK, it was taken private in 2006, but yes, it's a retirement specialist builder, which has 70% of that market, which is a growing market, and that is looking at a valuation of about £1 billion in an IPO, which you can imagine is going to be a popular one.
I would imagine so. Mm. I mean, retirement properties is something I've been looking at from a personal perspective, not for me.
Something you haven't told us, John?
No, I'm retiring. So no, we're looking at my wife's father is elderly. So we're looking to move him closer to us. McCarthy and Stone building a big development at the top of my road. So we are going to have a look at that. They're a big developer, and they're premium. So the prices of these flats are not cheap.
Yeah,
not cheap at all. But of course, the other aspect of the retirement properties is the service charges.
Yeah.
So yeah, lots of sort of on-site care facilities, that kind of stuff, and yeah, it's expensive stuff. So I would imagine a good business for someone to be in. So again, something I suspect we'll take a good look at. Definitely.
It will be interesting when it floats to have a proper look at you know the operating margins and so forth and how that compares to the standard house builders, and are they really a premium, you know, are they a premium, should they be given a premium valuation?
I would suspect so, but
are they for sale then, or
you buy them? Yeah. You buy them,
so it's a house builder but
essentially
in a niche.
Exactly.
with services added on,
which I guess was where the extra margin potentially comes from.
It's going to be very interesting to have a deep look at that when it comes out.
Absolutely. Is it something you've come across in your travels as a property journalist in the past, Stephen? Retirement?
Well, not really. I mean, Helical Bar, which is a developer, it got into it pre-crisis, I know, and it has long been considered an attractive niche. But the property sector, as far as I know, doesn't do it at all, with the exception of Helical. And I don't think Helical's done much in it lately. I can't think of anyone who has their fingers in that pie. So
it's funny, you thought it'd be you know, more prevalent on the market given the demographic trends that we're seeing.
No, absolutely. And everyone agrees that there's a underprovision of this kind of property, and you know that we've got this ancient housing stock completely ill-adapted to the aging population, and yeah, it's a common complaint you hear that there's a business need for it. But anyway, so that might be a reason why it attracts a premium on the stock market, the fact that it's a pure play on a sector you can't really get elsewhere, seemingly.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking of property, let's quickly turn to your Taking Stock column this week, because you've written about commercial property.
Yeah, I had an interesting chat with a guy called Mike Brown, who's the CEO of a company called Pressbury that used to run Max Property and now runs Secure Income Trust, and that kind of made me want to have a look at commercial property again. And it's a market which is doing incredibly well, basically, and everyone is bullish on it, and obviously that does make one nervous a bit. But a bit like the house builders we were talking about, with Algie Hall, our tips editor, it's sort of hard to see what, you know, it'll turn at some point, but it doesn't look like that the moment has yet come. I mean, the bull factors are that it offers an attractive yield, particularly relative to bonds, but the differential between property yield and property and yield on bonds is sufficiently large that even as yields increase on bonds, you wouldn't think there'd be a massive sell-off. And the issues that the industry has faced in the past, in the late 80s, it was undone by overdevelopment. That is definitely not the case at the moment. 2006-07, it was undone by high debt levels. That's really not the case, certainly not with the major REITs. I mean, not least because the banking sector has been so reluctant to lend until quite recently. So it's hard to, I mean, you know, maybe this is the problem, is that with every crisis there's a different reason, and it's hard to see what that is in advance. But certainly the reasons for the last two property downturns don't look like they're going to be repeated.
Indeed. I mean, in terms of their tenants, I mean, you know, UK economic growth is strong.
And we've got, you know, this healthy economy, and this is I guess why it's been pretty popular with investors lately, because it's not exposed to the problems we've seen elsewhere. You know, there's endless problems, you know, the China and the emerging market slowdown, Russian sanctions, all these. You know, I was speaking to the chief executive of Rotork on Wednesday, sort of engineering business, which always we've got used to it reporting record profits every year, and this year it said it's not going to, because, you know, it's been hit by Russian sanctions and China and strong pounds and the rest of it. And none of these problems, which have faced even the most high quality of the kind of international-minded businesses we have.
Which Rotork is.
Yeah, which Rotork is.
Super high-quality business.
Exactly. Even those really high-quality ones have been hit by problems. And you don't have to worry about that with property, because it's a very parochial industry. Hammerson's the only one that owns stuff outside of the UK.
That's in France.
In France, and it's just bought this Irish business as well. But yeah, the rest of them are really very local businesses that's exposed to the reasonably strong business recovery.
I mean, I guess one thing you mentioned here is to be wary of those companies that perhaps have exposure to shopping centres.
To retail. Yeah, so retail is the weak spot and has been the weak spot in the recovery. And that's because of e-commerce, competition from e-commerce, and the fact that it was overdeveloped in 2005, 6, 7. So there's still a legacy of shops that hasn't really been eaten up by the recovery retail chains have reduced their store estates.
Mm. Well, I noticed this week that Walmart has had a big profit warning. In fact, today.
Yeah.
It's blaming Amazon, I guess, pretty squarely for that.
Well, yeah, it's investing in e-commerce. It's really very interesting that it's said that because it needs to it's having to pay its staff a bit more, which is another local theme in the UK, which property isn't exposed to, but mm-hmm. a lot of businesses are. But also, yeah, it's having to invest in e-commerce. And that is very expensive. And there's an example of that in this week's results section here. N Brown is another company which has long been touted as a recovery story. But yeah, it's just the costs of transitioning from a catalogue business to this plus-sized retailer.
I know it very well.
Yeah, you used to cover it.
I don't shop there.
Yeah. Yeah, it used to be a catalogue retailer predominantly, yes. and it's been shifting towards a digital model. You know, you'd have thought it was well-placed.
Well, it used to say that it was well-placed. We are especially well-placed to make the transition towards digital retail.
And we all know that Next, as a catalogue retailer, has done the digital transition really well. But for some reason, N Brown hasn't been able to do it without incurring massive costs. So that's just a side point. But yeah, Walmart has discovered that it can't continue to churn out profit growth and keep on top of new technology, which is a problem that most retailers have had.
Indeed. So I guess the kind of lessons to learn are, if you're going for property, there's still a lot of life left in that market in commercial property, but be careful of perhaps some of the segments of it.
Yeah, be careful of some of the segments and be careful of over-complacency. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we're there yet, but at some point the cycle will turn, and we all know from history that these things happen in a way that you don't always expect, and so you just have to be quite wary. But it all does look, it's going gangbusters. It looks like that's continuing. No particular reason to worry yet.
Okay. So we stick with retail very briefly while we're on results. DFS had maiden results. Looked all right.
Yeah. In fact, we were moved to put them on a speculative buy because the shares are trading on 13 times earnings, and you know, it's not a super high quality business, but it looks like it's a reasonably attractive entry price. You know, they had like-for-like growth of nearly 5% the year to August, which is pretty good.
Partly this is a housing story, I guess.
Yes, and a credit story.
A credit and housing.
Yeah, absolutely.
When both are in good health, then you're going to sell more sofas.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And it's got a store rollout and a digital story as well. And an international rollout. It opened its first overseas store last November near Amsterdam. And hopes to open some more. It's also
Amsterdam. I know some other domestically focused retailers that went out there. Carpet Right.
Carpet Right springs to mind.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Carpet Right because it really is a strong parallel. I mean, Carpet Right over the summer, I think it was, came out and said we want to broaden our appeal, by which it meant attract more middle class customers.
I've bought carpets from Carpet Right. I would consider myself middle class.
Well, you are fulfilling every dream.
Absolutely.
But DFS has said almost exactly the same thing in its results.
Might seem sensible.
Yeah.
Seems sensible.
Well, I suppose the risk is that they have been very successful at focusing on a certain demographic, and I guess they don't want to alienate that demographic.
But, yes. There's another listed sofa retailer, funny enough, SCS, which... doesn't look so rosy there.
There was a profit warning at SES just after Easter.
Right, and they hadn't been on the market very long at that point.
The classic retailer excuse.
I thought they blame the weather.
The weather. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, that's going to stop you buying a sofa.
Yeah, I'm remembering now. This was
not
just
staying in.
This was just after Easter, wasn't it? And actually, from what I remember, analysts at the time struggled to find an explanation. Mm. It was a really kind of mysterious one, and actually, I think a lot of it kind of burnt bridges with some of the people in the city who thought they hadn't been very upfront about their guidance.
If ever I see a retailer blaming the weather for anything, that's it. It's a sell. it's the shonkiest excuse ever. Okay, let's enough of sofas. One more result that I think is probably worth mentioning is Bellway.
Yeah, back to housing. I mean, this was a very, very strong set of results.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Proving the doubters wrong.
Absolutely. You look at that five-year track record. I mean, pre-tax profit 2011, 67 million. 2015, 354.
I guess again, it's hard to see what's going, could go wrong, because it's like you said with the commercial property sector, all the things that have derailed this sector in the past are not there anymore.
No, very cash. I mean, it does actually have some debt, 2% of its NAV. So, I mean, it's very, very, their balance sheets across the sector are very, very healthy. And, well, we all know there's a housing shortage. And so there's strong demand backed by government, you know, a newly re-elected government policy. And the interest rate story obviously has derailed sentiment at points in the last 5 years.
Although I think it's fair to say that the interest rate rise expectation is going to be pushed out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, it's been pushed out and pushed out, and the banking sector is getting more competitive as the recovery continues. So even if it's not obvious that even if wholesale interest rates increase slightly, maybe mortgage rates will remain very low because the banks will reduce their margins. I mean, that's what's been happening for the past couple of years anyway. So
still a buy.
Still a buy.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll be interesting the next few months to see the house builders because, you know, traditionally, and Simon Thompson has written about this every year, there's traditionally a first quarter surge in house building shares. Last year, he pressed the go button on that particular strategy in November and it served him wonderfully again. So it'd be interesting to see whether we get that once more. Can these shares go another leap forward or not? I mean, it's just one to watch out for, one to be aware of for our readers, that it has worked almost every single year for years.
The funny thing is, it hasn't been just the first quarter, has it?
Not this year, no.
And I remember reading that the house builders have actually outperformed the FTSE All Share in each one of the last 6 years, I think I read. Mm. So it's been a remarkably consistent story.
Yeah.
Well, that's what a shortage of homes does for you. That's actually something that Jonas is discussing this week in his Property Matters column, which we've got this week. And Jonas is also looking at London property in the sector focus.
Yeah, there's lots of property in this issue. Interesting one. This was on the back of the government's sort of latest initiative to David Cameron announced last year at the party conference that they were going to seemingly the initiative was that they were going to replace the social housing allocation that house builders have to build alongside in their private developments with affordable homes to buy which on the face of it sounds good for house builders again, because homes to buy tend to be higher margin than selling them wholesale to a housing association. But anyway, it's all a bit unclear what the actual initiative is. It's yet another political initiative. But
what it doesn't seem to mean is that there's going to be a flood of new houses
being
built. And
the only solution to that is social house building, as I think Jonas... It's just the obvious...
Or council house
council
building.
House building.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is evaporated. There's none in the UK. Yeah.
And Jonas includes the chart, which makes that perfect obvious, which is house building back since the Second World War, whatever it is. And, you know, that actually private house buildings remain fairly steady, but the delta, the amount by which it's fallen, is all to do with the decline of public house building.
Absolutely. And, you know, given the government's desire to save money, certainly at a local level, it's hard to see that ever changing in terms of, you know, a sudden surge in public sector house building.
Yeah.
Just cannot see it happening. There you go. Conditions good for house builders. So keep buying, it seems. Keep buying. Okay, that will do for companies, I think. Let's talk about James's pieces this week. James, bet you're glad you turned up on time.
Yes.
right, so you've done two pieces for us this week, both of which were very, very interesting indeed. Let's talk about the high yield system first, because this is something we dug up from the archives and you kind of put back together for us.
Yeah, it was originally an IC feature from, I think, the 1930s.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago where they were... looking at a long-running system, looking at sort of running high-yield stocks and selling those that fell below the portfolio average. It's fair to say that I've modified it a bit. I mean, the temptation is enormous with a supposedly passive system to tinker with it. But I couldn't resist on the full-year review, because I had to go back and backtest and think, to make this system... something that you could follow and use, we had to do something about costs.
Yeah. The turnover was too high. I've borrowed a few portfolio management tricks from Anthony Garner, one of our columnists as well, specifically not selling stocks unless the system necessitated a 5% move in the portfolio holding.
In the balancing
of the portfolio. Yeah. Initially, the portfolio was an equal weighted system, so every 3 months you would look at the 15 holdings and you would make buys and sells in order to have an equal weighting
to bring it back into
balance. That sort of a bit nonsensical in some cases. I mean, we've got in the high yield system, which was run in July, you had companies like BHP Billiton, Anglo American. It's in the bloodletting in the commodities markets, you're effectively you're buying something which is on a downtrend just for the sake of symmetry, which seems absurd.
Yeah, I mean they've really hit the performance of the overall portfolio. I mean, BHP down 38%. Anglo-American down 52%. Mm. Everything else looks like it's doing okay.
Yeah, and it's some quite stable defensives there. When you look at them, Imperial Tobacco. One of the criticisms of the portfolio would be it wasn't particularly balanced. It's a lot of the companies there have high exposure to infrastructure spending and the property boom in the UK. A couple of REITs in there.
Good performance there.
For reasons as Stephen discussed. In general, so we introduced diversification rules because we were very exposed to the broad financial sectors, life insurers, banks, and financial services. So the idea is now quite balanced now. Ostensibly we've got several different sectors in there, but still a lot of those companies have exposure to the same macro trends.
Yeah, well, you're sticking with the minus that you mentioned here, we've discussed this on this podcast that the bloodletting may be over. And in fact, miners are bouncing strongly today and have done over the past couple of weeks. The yields look good and potentially safe as well.
That's the beauty of this system, really, is that it puts a brake on panic selling.
Yeah.
In an issue, for example, with the miners, because their yield have held up, you only sell a company if it falls below the portfolio average yield in this.
Yeah.
So that's kept the miners in it, which means actually we haven't panic sold out of something and effectively crystallized a loss. It would be a disastrous world in which BHP Billiton went pop. So we've stayed in it. We've stayed in for the long term with this system.
Yeah.
So,
and it is working. I mean, the returns aren't spectacular, but they're certainly beating the market. And for a passive, essentially a tracking system. Mm. I mean, this is creating a little bit of alpha, and that's what we want to see.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's 2.76%. This is assuming the equal weighting, of course. And what we did when we went back, taking a hypothetical 150-gram pot. And this is available on the IC website. You can see the past trades as well. Looked at the exact dividend payments, income tax, assuming the higher rate, which obviously will change in April 2016. And looked at transaction charges as well. And with all that taken into account, the overall gain with the only rebalancing of winners, so i.e. a company with positive share price momentum, we would rebalance. But we wouldn't rebalance a loser. Which in that version of the portfolio, it's seen the miners, the holding, proportionately fall in the portfolio, which helps a lot with overall performance. Then that would have done 3.45%.
Okay.
So with all costs included, which that's quite a significant outperformance.
That's decent. So are we done with the tweaking?
I think so now. I mean, I'm also going to change it to Claudio Ranieri is now back in the Premier League as manager of Leicester City.
Doing very well.
Yes, he's doing very well, and so is the high yield system.
Good.
But I think Tinkerman is done for now.
Right, good. Glad to hear it. Okay, let's talk about quickly the tactical portfolio you put together. It's quite interesting. So this is based on asset allocation principles that we've discussed before in the magazine. And what you've done is look at some of the literature, some of the current thinking of some of the big houses out there, see what their tactical allocations should be, what they're thinking at the moment, and you've put a portfolio together, or some portfolio ideas together?
Some ideas, not entirely based on what the investment houses have done. What they produce, it's not intended as investment advice, and it's certainly not intended for a retail investor audience. But obviously, now that investors have access to low-cost ETFs, it's actually it's far easier to put together a few portfolio ideas based on and some of that research. So I was looking at whether Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, whether they were overweight or underweight in their allocations towards various asset classes. So within equities, obviously, Investor Chronicle is very interested in. Overall, you know, they prefer Japan and Europe to the US, which they believe believe it. But you know, that said, the US has performed well, and the idea is I think that being underweight does not mean being out of a market. So in my allocation, which yeah, I've sort of finger in the air stuff. Really, I've got a 7.5% allocation to US shares via the Vanguard ETF, and I've got a higher allocation towards European and Japanese shares. I've changed it slightly to be more the bias of a domestic UK investor. So I've got a domestic bias towards UK shares, or and you know, my bonds allocation, the basic split of it's based on the IC ideal portfolio balance strategy, which was 50% equities, 40% bonds, 5% cash, and 5% gold. I've tweaked that significantly to give a broader asset allocation. I've introduced bond substitutes in the 40% bond allocation, so only basically, again, for reasons of cost effectiveness. In a low interest rates as a global phenomenon, so it makes sense, really. I think, you know, just to have your government debt in UK debt. I mean, you're not a big investment house. You don't need to be. You're not doing clever immunization strategies or whatever. You're looking at, you know, so something that's just going to be safe and reduce the risk of your portfolio. So UK debt, I've put 10% in high yield corporate debt, which was something which again, as we talk about interest rates being rises kicked further down the line into the long grass, potentially going into 2016. You know, the Morgan Stanley did highlight corporate debt as potentially a good area. So we've got an allocation there for reasons, you know, Stephen touched on with the yield on property. I've actually stuck some of the bonds allocation into the property.
Not so keen on commodities. I know there's been a bit of a change of heart there from the big houses, but you're not so keen.
You know, their reasoning is sound. As you say, we've seen a bounce in the miners in the last couple of days. I think if you're a private investor, wait for a clear uptrend on something like that. With it, it's not going to be the core. It's a satellite holding exposure to commodities. We've got exposure to things like large mining stocks with our FTSE, our UK large shares, large cap allocation here anyway. As if there's a powerful uptrend, we've got plenty of cash in the portfolio to jump in if we want to, and we can tweak things.
Okay, good stuff. Well, the ETFs you've outlined all from our top 50 ETFs, so can all be bought very cheaply, and ones that we recommend as kind of doing what they say on the tin. So this is a strategy you could play, very cheaply, which, given that asset allocation is such an important factor in overall returns, this could actually be a very sensible portfolio for someone who doesn't really have a lot of time on their hands.
Yeah, it's something that we can take a view on every 3 months, and it wouldn't take a lot of trades.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, thanks, James. And that's about it. I mean, actually, it's quite a action-packed magazine this week. We haven't even discussed Barclays, and we're not going to either. Give them the airtime. Got a new chief exec, or they're about to name a new chief exec, for what it's worth. What else have we got in the magazine? So the cover feature, armor-plated shares. It's a companion piece to last week's cover feature, and it's about competitive advantage and the barriers to entry that companies have, which potentially makes some very good investments. And what Philip Reinen is doing there is essentially telling you how to spot them with some good examples. But you know, learning how to do this kind of stuff yourself is really what makes a difference. And there's a tool, a spreadsheet on our website that you can download that comes to the feature that will perhaps give you some help doing that. Stock screen from Algy. It's a growth screen looking at AIM shares using his genuine value ratio, TM Algy Hall. It's basically a low peg high yield screen. And we obviously have all the usual stuff, tips. We've got comment from Bearball, from the Trader, from Dillo and Simon Thompson. Lots in the PF section as well, which they will no doubt be discussing on their podcast, which you can hear on the website this week too. So thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, James. And happy birthday to us again. And we'll be back next week. Thank you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.